Chapter 23. Behind the most ancient part of Holborn, London, where certain gabled houses some centuries of age still stand looking on the public way, as if disconsolately looking for the old bourne that has long run dry, is a little nook composed of two irregular quadrangles, called Staple Inn. It is one of those nooks, the turning into which out of the clashing street imparts to the relieved pedestrian the sensation of having put cotton in his ears and velvet soles on his boots. It is one of those nooks where a few smoky sparrows twitter in smoky trees, as though they called to one another, "Let us play at country," apostrophe, and where a few feet of garden mold and a few yards of gravel enable them to do that refreshing violence to their tiny understandings. Moreover, it is one of those nooks which are legal nooks, and it contains a little hall with a little lantern in its roof. To what obstructive purposes devoted, and at whose expense, this history knoweth not. In the days when Cloisterham took offense at the existence of a railroad afar off, as menacing that sensitive constitution, the property of us Britons, the odd fortune of which sacred institution it is to be in exactly equal degrees croaked about, trembled for, and boasted of, whatever happens to anything, anywhere in the world. In those days no neighboring architecture of lofty proportions had arisen to overshadow Staple Inn. The westering sun bestowed bright glances on it, and the southwest wind blew into it unimpeded. Neither wind nor sun, however, favored Staple Inn one December afternoon toward 6 o'clock, when it was filled with fog, and candles shed murky and blurred rays through the windows of all its then occupied sets of chambers. Notably from a set of chambers in a corner house in the little inner quadrangle, presenting in black and white over its ugly portal the mysterious inscription, PJT 1747, in which set of chambers, never having troubled his head about the inscription, unless to bethink himself at odd times on glancing up at it, that haply it might mean perhaps John Thomas, or perhaps Joe Tyler, sat Mr. Grewgious writing by his fire. Who could have told, by looking at Mr. Grewgious, whether he had ever known ambition or disappointment? He had been bred to the bar, and had laid himself out for chamber practice, to draw deeds, convey the wise at call, apostrophe as Pistol says. But conveyancing, and he had made such a very indifferent marriage of it, that they had separated by consent, if there can be said to be separation, where there has never been coming together. No. Coy conveyancing would not come to Mr. Grewgious. She was wooed, not won, and they went their several ways. But an arbitration being blown towards him by some unaccountable wind, and he gaining great credit in it as one indefatigable in seeking outright and doing right, a pretty fat receivership was next blown into his pocket by a wind more traceable to its source. So, by chance, he had found his niche. Receiver and agent now, to two rich estates, and deputing their legal business, in an amount worth having, to a firm of solicitors on the floor below, he had snuffed out his ambition, supposing him to have ever lighted it, and had settled down with his snuffers for the rest of his life under the dry vine and fig tree of P.J. T., who planted in 1747. Many accounts and account books, many files of correspondence, and several strong boxes, garnish Mr. Grewgious's room. They can scarcely be represented as having lumbered it, so conscientious and precise was their orderly arrangement. The apprehension of dying suddenly, and leaving one fact or one figure with any incompleteness or obscurity attaching to it, would have stretched Mr. Grewgious stone dead any day. The largest fidelity to a trust was the lifeblood of the man. There are sorts of lifeblood that course more quickly, more gaily, more attractively, but there is no better sort in circulation. There was no luxury in his room. Even its comforts were limited to its being dry and warm, and having a snug though faded fireside. What may be called its private life was confined to the hearth, and all easy chair, and an old-fashioned occasional round table that was brought out upon the rug after business hours, from a corner where it elsewise remained turned up like a shining mahogany shield. Behind it, when standing thus on the defensive, was a closet, usually containing something good to drink. An outer room was the clerk's room. Mr. Grewgious's sleeping room was across the common stair, and he held some not empty cellarage at the bottom of the common stair. 300 days in the year, at least, he crossed over to the hotel in Furnival's Inn for his dinner, and after dinner crossed back again, to make the most of these simplicities until it should become broad business day once more, with P.J. T., date 1747. As Mr. Grewgious sat and wrote by his fire that afternoon, so did the clerk of Mr. Grewgious sit and write by his fire. A pale, puffy-faced, dark-haired person of 30, with big dark eyes that wholly wanted luster, and a dissatisfied doughy complexion that seemed to ask to be sent to the baker's, this attendant was a mysterious being, possessed of some strange power over Mr. Grewgious. As though he had been called into existence, like a fabulous familiar, by a magic spell which had failed, when required to dismiss him, he stuck tight to Mr. Grewgious's stool, although Mr. Grewgious's comfort and convenience would manifestly have been advanced by dispossessing him. A gloomy person with tangled locks, and a general air of having been reared under the shadow of that baleful tree of Java which has given shelter to more lies than the whole botanical kingdom, Mr. Grewgious, nevertheless, treated him with unaccountable consideration. "Now, Bazard," apostrophe said Mr. Grewgious, on the entrance of his clerk, looking up from his papers as he arranged them for the night, "what is in the wind besides fog?" Apostrophe, 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 Mr. Drood, apostrophe, said Bazard. What of him? Apostrophe, apostrophe, has called, apostrophe, said Bazard. You might have shown him in. Apostrophe, I am doing it, apostrophe, said Bazard. The visitor came in accordingly. Dear me. Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Mr. Grewgious, looking round his pair of office candles. I thought you had called and merely left your name and gone. How do you do, Mr. Edwin? Dear me, you're choking. Apostrophe, it's this fog, apostrophe, returned Edwin, and it makes my eyes smart, like cayenne pepper. Apostrophe, is it really so bad as that? Pray undo your wrappers. It's fortunate I have so good a fire, but Mr. Bazard has taken care of me. Apostrophe, no I haven't, apostrophe, said Mr. Bazard at the door. Ah, then it follows that I must have taken care of myself without observing it, apostrophe, said Mr. Grewgious. Pray be seated in my chair. No, I beg. Coming out of such an atmosphere, in my chair, apostrophe, Edwin took the easy chair in the corner, and the fog he had brought in with him, and the fog he took off with his greatcoat and neck shawl, was speedily licked up by the eager fire. I look, apostrophe, said Edwin, smiling, as if I had come to stop. Apostrophe, apostrophe, by the by, apostrophe, cried Mr. Grewgious. Excuse my interrupting you. Do stop. The fog may clear in an hour or two. We can have dinner in from just across Holborn. You had better take your cayenne pepper here than outside. Pray stop and dine. Apostrophe, you are very kind, apostrophe, said Edwin, glancing about him, as though attracted by the notion of a new and relishing sort of gypsy party. Not at all, apostrophe, said Mr. Grewgious. You are very kind to join issue with a bachelor in chambers and take potluck. And I'll ask, apostrophe, said Mr. Grewgious, dropping his voice, and speaking with a twinkling eye, as if inspired with a bright thought. I'll ask Bazard. He mightn't like it else. Bazard. Apostrophe, Bazard reappeared. Dine presently with Mr. Drood and me. Apostrophe, if I am ordered to dine, of course I will, sir, apostrophe, was the gloomy answer. Save the man. Apostrophe, apostrophe, cried Mr. Grewgious. You're not ordered. You're invited. Apostrophe, Thank you, sir, apostrophe said Bazzard. In that case I don't care if I do. Apostrophe, that's arranged. And perhaps you wouldn't mind, apostrophe said Mr. Grugis, stepping over to the Hotel Infernivals, and asking them to send in materials for laying the cloth. For dinner we'll have a tureen of the hottest and strongest soup available, and we'll have the best made dish that can be recommended, and we'll have a joint such as a haunch of mutton, and we'll have a goose, or a turkey, or any little stuffed thing of that sort, that may happen to be in the bill of fare. In short, we'll have whatever there is on hand. Apostrophe, these liberal directions Mr. Grugis issued with his usual air of reading an inventory, or repeating a lesson, or doing anything else by rote. Bazzard, after drawing out the round table, withdrew to execute them. I was a little delicate, you see, apostrophe said Mr. Grugis, in a lower tone, after his clerk's departure, about employing him in the foraging or commissariat department. Because he mightn't like it. Apostrophe, he seems to have his own way, sir, apostrophe remarked Edwin. His own way? Apostrophe returned Mr. Grugis. Oh dear no. Poor fellow, you quite mistake him. If he had his own way, he wouldn't be here. Apostrophe, I wonder where he would be. Apostrophe, Edwin thought. But he only thought it, because Mr. Grugis came and stood himself with his back to the other corner of the fire, and his shoulder blades against the chimney piece, and collected his skirts for easy conversation. I take it, without having the gift of prophecy, that you have done me the favor of looking in to mention, that you are going down yonder, where I can tell you, you are expected, and to offer to execute any little commission from me to my charming ward, and perhaps to sharpen me up a bit in any proceedings? Eh, Mr. Edwin? Apostrophe, I called, sir, before going down, as an act of attention. Apostrophe, of attention. Apostrophe, said Mr. Grugis. Ah, of course, not of impatience. Apostrophe, impatience, sir. Apostrophe, Mr. Grugis had meant to be arch, not that he in the remotest degree expressed that meaning, and had brought himself into scarcely supportable proximity with the fire, as if to burn the fullest effect of his archness into himself, as other subtle impressions are burned into hard metals. But his archness suddenly flying before the composed face and manner of his visitor, and only the fire remaining, he started and rubbed himself. I have lately been down yonder, apostrophe said Mr. Grugis, rearranging his skirts, and that was what I referred to when I said I could tell you you are expected. Apostrophe, indeed, sir. Yes, I knew that pussy was looking out for me. Apostrophe, do you keep a cat down there? Apostrophe asked Mr. Grugis. Edwin colored a little as he explained. I call Rosa pussy. Apostrophe, oh, really, apostrophe said Mr. Grugis, smoothing down his head. That's very affable. Apostrophe, Edwin glanced at his face, uncertain whether or no he seriously objected to the appellation. But Edwin might as well have glanced at the face of a clock. A pet name, sir, apostrophe he explained again. Umps, apostrophe said Mr. Grugis, with a nod. But with such an extraordinary compromise between an unqualified assent and a qualified dissent, that his visitor was much disconcerted. Did Prosa apostrophe Edwin began by way of recovering himself. Prosa? Apostrophe repeated Mr. Grugis. I was going to say pussy, and changed my mind. Did she tell you anything about the landlesses? Apostrophe, no, apostrophe said Mr. Grugis. What is the landlesses? An estate? A villa? A farm? Apostrophe, a brother and sister. The sister is at the nun's house, and has become a great friend of P. Apostrophe, Prosa's, apostrophe Mr. Grugis struck in, with a fixed face. She is a strikingly handsome girl, sir, and I thought she might have been described to you, or presented to you perhaps. Apostrophe, neither, apostrophe said Mr. Grugis. But here is Bazard. Apostrophe, Bazard returned, accompanied by two waiters, an immovable waiter, and a flying waiter, and the three brought in with them as much fog as gave a new roar to the fire. The flying waiter, who had brought everything on his shoulders, laid the cloth with amazing rapidity and dexterity, while the immovable waiter, who had brought nothing, found fault with him. The flying waiter then highly polished all the glasses he had brought, and the immovable waiter looked through them. The flying waiter then flew across Holborn for the soup, and flew back again, and then took another flight for the made dish, and flew back again, and then took another flight for the joint and poultry, and flew back again, and between whiles, took supplementary flights for a great variety of articles, as it was discovered from time to time that the immovable waiter had forgotten them all. But let the flying waiter cleave the air as he might, he was always reproached on his return by the immovable waiter for bringing fog with him, and being out of breath. At the conclusion of the repast, by which time the flying waiter was severely blown, the immovable waiter gathered up the tablecloth under his arm with a grand air, and having sternly, not to say with indignation, looked on at the flying waiter, while he set the clean glasses round, directed a valedictory glance towards Mr. Grewgious, conveying, "Let it be clearly understood between us, that the reward is mine, and that nil is the claim of this slave," apostrophe, and pushed the flying waiter before him out of the room. It was like a highly finished miniature painting representing my lords of the circumlocution department, commandership in chief of any sort, government. It was quite an edifying little picture, to be hung on the line in the National Gallery. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.